Joining us now, it is Keith Law, one of our favorites. Good morning, Keith. How are you doing, sir?
Good. How are you?
Good, good. So the final question today, I'm going to give you the option because you're a game for this. And the reason I do it is you're a smart guy. You know so much more than just baseball. And when interesting people talk about interesting things, I just think that makes for good radio. So at the end, either a question about books, food, or cats. It is your choice. I have questions for all three. I will allow you to choose which one. Is that fair with you, sir?
That's fair. I say we change it up. For having done the cat thing a couple of times, why don't we change it up and do books this week?
Done and done.
We can even rotate if you like.
I would, because if we get rid of all the cat questions, we will lose 33% of our audience. And
it seems like that on Twitter. The Twitter sphere seems to like the cats.
They really do. Well, you know, especially cute memes are always fun. Let's start with the easy, lazy sports question. And
sure.
It's the junk food of sports radio, but junk food is tasty, and as long as it's in moderation, it's okay. I was asked this question on the radio station. If you could only keep one, Edwin Encarnacion or Jose Bautista, would you be focusing your time and attention on? I feel this question is a little unfair because Edwin has been on fire, so there's some recency bias, but you're a smart person, and there's big picture consequences as well.
Nice use of recency bias, by the way.
Thank you.
One of my favorites.
I use it in everyday conversation. I find it's delightful.
There you go. It's a great cognitive biases are really fun at cocktail parties.
No, everyone is surrounded by you, and they just want you to keep talking their ear off all night.
Yes, exactly. But you know what? I would have said Encarnacion anyway, because I think he's going to come cheaper. Ultimately, I think, and not even just because of Bautista's public comments, I think when hitting the market, I think Bautista is probably going to find more interest. He's got the longer track record. He's got the more well-rounded offensive profile. He can play a position. He can actually probably play a couple of positions. Encarnacion's best position is in the batter's box. So along those lines, I would say, yeah, I'd probably focus more on Encarnacion because you're more likely to get a deal you can live with. I think we've talked before how I feel like both guys are probably going to be overpriced, given their age, given the likely future decline in their offensive performance. You want the shorter commitment, and of course you want the lower dollar value. I think you're more likely to get that on Encarnacion, even if we throw Bautista's comments about wanting, what did he want, a five-year deal or something completely crazy? Just throw that out the window, because I don't think the market's giving him that anyway. Even that aside, I'd still say Encarnacion.
Join on the yeah, and I agree. And you're right. I mean, the great point is just about the money and the dollar value. And mm-hmm. You know, you see what Ortiz means to Boston, and that not easily. I shouldn't say that, but Edwin can certainly play that role for many more years. It feels like with the Toronto Blue Jays.
Mm-hmm.
So here in Toronto, our sports bellies are filled with happy. After the horrible loss to Detroit when Aaron Sanchez was fantastic, the Jays 7-2 in their last nine, outscoring their opponents. They're clubbing teams to death. But we're going from Philadelphia to Baltimore. And mm-hmm. I feel bad for Aaron Sanchez because he got to see the other four pitchers pitch against the worst scoring team in baseball in Philadelphia. Now Sanchez has to go up against Baltimore and all those home runs. For people that maybe haven't been following the AL East, what is Sanchez looking at tonight?
So the Orioles, they're a very weird team. It's still kind of surprising to me that they're as far, I think they're about 10 games above 500. Now, some of that is that they won their first seven games and since then have been closer to a 500 team. But I would have guessed they would have fallen further behind by now because they're running on one cylinder. This is a power-hitting lineup. They've got a bunch of sort of brute sluggers who aren't great at getting on base, are not high contact hitters, but hit a lot of home runs. It's a good defensive unit too. That's really what they've got going for them. The starting pitching is atrocious. It is the worst of any contender, I would say, in the American League. Other than Chris Tillman, there is not a starting pitcher in their rotation that I think would be even a three on most other contenders. And as I said, I think a good pitcher can get through this lineup pretty effectively by trying to keep the ball out of the middle, upper middle, section of the strike zone. You've got a bunch of power hitters who are looking for something they can elevate and are not particularly good hitters overall. Mark Trumbo has, I think, 19 home runs. He's been a terrible hitter pretty much his entire major league career. If you make a mistake, he destroys it. If you throw him a slider hitting down and away, even within the zone, he's likely to swing and miss. And he's probably the most extreme example of their hitters, but there is an approach. There is a plan of attack that should work against a lineup filled with guys like that, other than Manny Machado, who's the one guy I say that is a complete hitter. If you get around Machado, you can get after most of the other guys in that Orioles lineup. And yet, nobody's really done that effectively this season.
Moving over to the front office, some more big picture. We're joined by Keith Law, baseball writer for ESPN. What can the influence of a spike, or let me word it like this. The Jays are averaging about 12,000 more fans per home game this year versus last year.
Mm-hmm.
Can that have any influence on what a front office does in terms of being aggressive by the trade deadline? And because I know a lot of fans, they're going to make the link, and I sometimes make that link as well. It's like, oh, more fans, more money. You're kind of in a win-now approach in some respects. Can this have an impact?
It can in two ways. If they're getting more fans than they budgeted, so their revenue has actually come in ahead of expectations, ownership could bank that as profit, or they could go to the front office and say, here's another $5 million to go make an acquisition at some point over the course of the season. I don't know what they budgeted and if they've come in ahead or below that. So it's not fair to look and say, well, they've got extra money. They might have already spent that money figuring they were going to get this extra, what is that, 800,000 or 900,000 fans over the course of the season. The other thing it may affect is if ownership is attuned to public perception and feels like, look, we're drawing well, we're popular, the city is talking about us. Obviously now is prime time because the Leafs are done. I mean, it's prime time all over the North America where basketball is ending, hockey's over, baseball is king for about 2 months now. And a lot of ownership groups would say, we want to capitalize on this. We want to keep the fans coming. We want to keep the positive PR image going. And a sell-off of any type obviously would probably work against that. And there are going to be some teams like the Yankees are kind of in this situation. They're not really very good. They're certainly not as good as the Blue Jays. They've got an older core. They've got a few pieces, especially in that bullpen, who'd be of interest to contenders. Would they be willing to turn their back, essentially, on the portion of the fan base that says we're never sellers, we're the New York Yankees, and make what is clearly the right move for the long term of the franchise? The Jays, it's a little different. I think it's more like will they buy rather than will they sell, but the calculus is probably pretty similar.
We got about a minute left. Recommend a good summer read. People that might not know this, you have a top 100 books. Your number one book, The Master and Margarita, fantastic. I thought you had Catch 22 a little low at 43. I would have ranked that higher, but a good summer read for the listeners.
Ooh, how about, it's within the last 10, 12 years or so, Richard Price wrote a book called Lush Life. Mm-hmm. That is, and he actually did writing for The Wire. I think he wrote for Homicide: Life on the Street.
Yeah.
And it's not a super, it's a light read in the sense that it will move fairly quickly. It's set in New York. It's got a ton of characters, a bunch of plot threads that all go together. But there's a suspense element too, because at the heart of it, like on The Wire and Homicide: Life on the Street, crime is at the center of it. The investigation of a crime, a guy who's wrongfully arrested, a corrupt cop, just creates this great little universe that totally sucked me into it right from the beginning. So even though it's not beach read, what people typically expect, to me a great summer read is just anything that's going to suck me in and I'm going to get lost in the universe of the book, of the characters, of the plot. And this is one that really does that.
If there's not Fabio on the cover, I have to disagree. Keith, thank you.
No bodice ripping, sorry.
Yeah, you know, as a pirate, something heaving would be nice. always appreciate, and I do appreciate this line, your review of The Trial. Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not after you.
Yes.
Well done.
Yep.
Thanks so much,
thank
Keith,
you
for joining us.
My pleasure.